So, it was pointed out yesterday that it is traditional to, well, I guess I just give up, that it's traditional to say a little bit about your personal history at the beginning of these talks, and but to try to relate it in some way to what you're about to talk about. So I was reminded, actually, I started out as an undergraduate in mathematics, and we had to write a senior thesis, and it was due on a Monday, and I'd been working on it for a number of months. And that Saturday night, I realized that, and had been up to that point mostly an exposition of and a reorganization of well-known results. But I realized on Saturday night that I actually could solve sort of a problem that had been sort of left aside in this field. So I kind of rewrote the whole thesis between Saturday night and Monday morning. And the connection is that in the course of conversations yesterday, I realized that there was an aspect of the data that I was using that I hadn't really appreciated. So I wound up redoing the talk last night. So that's the connection with my past life. After studying mathematics, I actually went on to graduate school in mathematics, taught for a while. Then I went to medical school. So that's what I do. And I took most of last year off as a sabbatical and spent it at Rosetta. And this came out of some work that I started last year. And so basically, the goal is to come up with an effective model, computational model for transcription in yeast. And I started off with the model that Harman and Eric had previously developed, generalized a little bit. And so I'll talk about that. So basically, I'll give you the motivation, describe the model and some of the computational aspects, and what's been done by validation and what the next steps are. So basically, the problem is given a set which has been prescribed in some other fashion of connections between transcription factors and genes. So whether it's by CHIP or by sequence analysis or some other method, to actually determine what the strengths of the interactions between the factors and the genes are in a high-throughput genome-wide sort of fashion, and what the variations in the effective levels of the transcription factors are from experiment to experiment. So when I talk about transcription factor levels, you should understand this as an abstraction. It represents the effective activity of that transcription factor in a mammalian system or in many systems, and might, for example, be related to the concentration of a phosphorylated version of the transcription factor rather than just the total amount of the protein that happens to be present in the cell. Now, one other comment is that this involves modeling of the transcription process working forward from the network rather than trying to deduce the network from, for example, expression data. And it turns out that this actually, and that trying to work backwards to the network from the expression data alone, was the approach that I started with. And I did enough simulations to convince myself that even in the presence of noiseless data that very faithfully follows the model that I will describe, so an absolutely ideal case, the recovery of the true transcription network is very difficult. Of the true connectivity between transcription factors and genes is extremely difficult. Consequently, you essentially, in order to succeed in this kind of thing, you have to start with a relatively good quality connection matrix. However, the method allows for sort of a some false positives, some false connections, which we hope will show up later with essentially weak coefficients. So why would we want to do it? Well, the preceding talks have done a much more eloquent job of explaining the motivation than I will. In mammalian systems, it's unlike yeast, where the transcription factors themselves are the main components of the signaling pathways. In mammalian systems, transcription factor activation is the endpoint of a multi-protein cascade in many cases, the endpoint of which is differential activation. However, the point of the signaling pathways in many cases is to turn on or off some particular set of genes. So this, although this doesn't really disentangle the entire regulatory network of mammalian cells by any means, it nonetheless represents a useful abstraction of what's actually going on in the cell. And the transcription factor levels are frequently hard to measure directly, and we don't really have a good assay, a good high-throughput assay for measuring activity of these transcription factor levels. So you can think of this as an indirect way of getting at this question. A second motivation is that, again, as I think people will appreciate from previous talks, the notion of dividing the genome or the transcriptome into disjoint, non-overlapping sets, which is usually what's done in clustering, doesn't really accurately represent underlying transcriptional activity. So you pointed out yesterday that yeast probably contains a few hundred transcription factors controlling about 6,000 genes, but that the average gene might hear from 4 to 10 transcription factors, and the average transcription factor might talk to anywhere from, let's say, 500 genes. So this notion of partitional clustering is fine for getting clues as to what motifs might be, but we know that clustering on the basis of expression data bears some clearly a relationship to, but a very imperfect one, to to the presence of motifs. And finally, a better understanding of the strength of transcription factor gene interactions should improve sort of our ability to model regulation and predict regulation. So the model is a simple one. It's similar to models that have been previously described with one small modification. So basically, in this model, transcription, the effect of the, well, let's see. So first of all, what are the symbols here? So Y sub EG is the expression data, which I typically take, as you'll hear, to be a ratio to some undefined baseline. And actually, the precise baseline is not terribly important for this type of analysis. So it's the expression level in experiment E for gene G. And we assume that each gene has a certain subset of transcription factors, F of G, that influence it. And the influence is defined by a coefficient that represents the interaction between the factor and the gene. And the level of that the effective level of that particular transcription factor in that experiment, plus say a noise term. And I work with log, with the log of the data, which is of course something of a which wasn't explained to me by God. There's no absolute reason for doing it. But what it means is that transcription factors act semi-independently, but in a multiplicative fashion. So an inhibitor inhibits, a certain amount of an inhibitor inhibits by 50% rather than by reducing the activity of transcription by a certain absolute amount. And then there's a noise term, and it's useful in doing these fittings and doesn't really complicate the computations, substantially if we allow the variance of this noise term to be to depend on E and G. And there are a number of advantages to that. First of all, we know that when you transform the data in this particular way, you produce a certain structure in the noise, and there may very well be a dependence between the variance of the noise and the mean level of y. And actually, taking the log transform tempers that influence somewhat. It's much more marked in if you don't take the log transform, but nonetheless, this kind of dependence might still exist. In addition, there can be experiment variation. And finally, the other useful and critical reason for having this kind of thing built into the model is that in most data sets, there's a fair amount of missing. Data. As you'll hear, the data sets I work with are gotten by aggregating many publicly available data sets, and there's about overall 10% incidence of missing or bad data. So X sub EF, as I said, is the effective level of factor F in a particular experiment. And it's this model is calibrated so that at baseline, at the sort of normal state of functioning of the cell that you're studying, all the transcription factors are hovering somewhere around zero. Okay, so you can think of this as sort of a perturbation of a baseline level of expression. Now the association, as I said, of G with F of G is the connection data, and it's assumed to be given. One thing I should add is that this model sort of has in mind a gene which is being tweaked and tuned, upregulated and downregulated as the cell goes through various vicissitudes in its life. It's not clear that this kind of model is appropriate for a complex developmentally regulated gene, which may be better modeled by discrete logic. But nonetheless, for cell line experiments and adult animal and human experiments, this seems to be a reasonable model. There are a couple of computational things to think about. One is there's an identifiability problem. You can obviously multiply all the coefficients for a gene by or for a particular factor by a certain number and divide this value of x by the same number. That doesn't have any effect on the predictions. So we just normalize the RMS value of the factors to be 1. This has the advantage, again, as you'll hear, I work by combining multiple data sets. And what this means is that the values of the factor don't change a great deal when you add more data. The factor values are all typically somewhere around 1. But again, as I said, that's just an arbitrary scaling problem. And it turns out for this one advantage of this particular model is that even though the number of variables is huge, so it's worth doing some counting and seeing sort of what the ratio of knowns to unknowns is. Basically, these are your measurements, so these are your knowns, so you have basically number of experiments times the number of genes. The number of unknowns are basically the levels of the factor in each experiment. So that is the ratio of these unknowns to this measurement is roughly the ratio of factors to genes. And in a completed genome, as we heard yesterday, that ratio might be perhaps 1 to 15 in humans, and maybe a little bit higher possibly a little bit higher in yeast. It's about 1 to 20 in E. coli. So typically, the ratio, if we had all the connection information, would be about 15 measurements for each unknown. This number of unknowns, obviously adds, but it's the total number of connections. And in most of the, and so that doesn't scale with the number of experiments. So when you deal with large numbers of experiments, and the data I'll show you are from working with about 700 experiments, basically it's this ratio of number of genes to number of identified factors that's actually that really defines the ratio of measurements to unknowns. And the nice thing is, this is a quadratic. The right-hand side is sort of bilinear in the factors and the coefficients. But what that means is, if you fix the set of factors or the set of coefficients, you have a linear problem. So the fitting is simply one of coming up with a reasonable initial guess, fixing the factors, optimizing the coefficients, fix the coefficients, optimize the factors. You do that a few times, and it turns out that defines a stable convergent algorithm, which finds a solution that's relatively independent in the data sets that I've dealt with of whatever initialization. And then I combine it with an optimizer as well that can handle large numbers of unknown variables. I happen to use this public domain one that works well for problems with like 100,000 unknowns, which is typical, called LBF-GSB. And what you get on this particular laptop is you can compute, you can fit all the coefficients and factors for around 2,600 genes. This was an earlier, or this was one of the data sets I was working with, for 700 experiments and 140 factors. So this is basically most of the known yeast factors, 700 experiments that I'll describe in a moment, and all the genes that are connected to at least one of these factors. So a fairly large data set, and that only takes a couple minutes. And that doesn't really that scales kind of linearly in the number of experiments.
And the FFG comes from where?
Ex machina. So in this, I'll describe where I got the two sets that I did. But yes, as I said, it turns out to be, I believe, too numerically difficult a problem to find it from expression data alone, even in a noiseless simulation. So how did I get the data? So what I did was I went to this website, YMGB, which unfortunately, I'm sorry, yes?
The solution that we get in the end, how sensible it is to your connection data? That would be, for example, do you try to add some connections for which you know that they are not real? I mean, do partition this alpha?
I haven't done that yet, but I do have a little bit. I do have one thing that addresses that point that I'll get to later. But a fair answer would be the correctness of the connection matrix is quite important for this to work. Or at least I should say that numerically this converges to a solution no matter what you do. However, for it to be a meaningful solution, as you'll see, it's essential to have a fairly good connection matrix. And I'll talk about that in a moment.
Can you describe two wrong connections?
Yes. Yes. But exactly where the breakdown point is, I don't know. Okay, but certainly you can hopefully the bad connections would show up with small values for the alphas.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the idea of fitting this model. But you cannot have like 70% bad connections. Okay, that gives very, very poor results, as I'll show you. Okay, so YMGV is a French site, no longer regrettably being updated, that contains pointers to a number of large publicly available data sets. So I basically went to YMGV. They have done, it took me some time to kind of reduplicate what they had already done, which was to download all these publicly available data sets, transform them to a uniform format. But basically that's what I did. I took about a dozen of their largest data sets. That's on the next slide. But anybody who's worked with yeast data will recognize these data sets. They were all transformed to ratio data, and then I looked through the data and attempted to identify whatever criterion the authors had used to distinguish between bad and good data, and basically ignored the bad data, effectively set the weight in that fitting to zero and used the good data. I have worked a little bit with error models, but they don't seem to make actually a lot of difference beyond throwing out the bad data. So what you wind up with, so you kind of use the ORFs to line up all these different data sets. So you wind up with about 6,300 ORFs, 725 experiments, so they're all ratio data, and about 9% missing data. And then the data was normalized so that the median ratio for every gene and every experiment was 1. These are the data sets, and I won't go over them in detail except to mention this particular data set. This is, as you'll see, the first 300 of the 700 experiments, and it was relatively carefully curated data. This was part of the sort of a dowry that Rosetta prepared in order to convince Merck to pay an optimistic price. So this was a well-curated data set, and the rest of these are of good quality, but probably not quite as good quality as the Rosetta compendium data. There is some systematic error information in this data as well that I believe we'll be able to use to roughly create an error model for some of these other data sets, but I haven't done that yet. Okay, so where did I take the connection data? Yes, I'm worried a little bit, but not too much. They're not that different. And in addition, to the extent that this is sort of a perturbation analysis, sort of a linear in the log space, sort of a linear perturbation analysis, the coefficients are sort of the slopes of change in log expression versus the change in the factor. I'm hypothesizing that this is relatively insensitive to that. So, yes, that's an issue, but I think it's a tractable one. So I used two sets of connection data, and one was the data that was referred to in the previous talk that came from the Young Lab, and this involves about 2,300 genes. There are about 4,600 connections, so there are about 2 transcription factors per gene on the average. That was using the default p-value to do a cutoff. So this is a fairly attractive data set to me because it covered about 40% of the yeast genome. And when you look at the percent of the variance in the and then the other one, I should say, so in addition, on their website, they have in the same format, more or less, as their experimental data, they have a digest of the data that was available about a year ago from YPD. And that is only covers about 600 genes. And it's about 1,100 connections, so roughly about a little bit less than two connections per gene, but covering only 10% of the genome, as opposed to 40% of the genome. The initial paper had suggested that the false positive rate was quite low, and the false negative rate, as estimated by what was known, was quite low, and the false positive rate, based on some limited experiments, was also reasonably low. I found that to be true for some transcription factors, like GAL4, for example, where there's clearly a high overlap. But if you look at the overlap between the Young data and the YPD data, only about 20% of the connections that are found in YPD were found by the Young data. So this makes me think that the false negative rate is actually somewhat higher than they had estimated. So if you look at the percent of variance in the data that's explained by these models, now I don't maintain that the percent of variance explained by the data is the optimum way of assessing the validity of a model, and I'll talk a little bit about one way of validating it. However, I think it is a useful base figure to start with. And what I've done here is I've contrasted two different, and this addresses your question, I looked at the percentage of the variance in the data that could be explained by using the connection matrix either from the Young data. So this is for about 2,600 genes, and here there's a known to unknown ratio of about around 10 to 1, measurement to unknown ratio about 10 to 1. For the YPD data, because the number of genes is substantially smaller, but the number of factors is about the same, the ratio here is about 5 to 1. Okay, so on that basis, we would expect this number to be somewhat higher than these numbers. What you can see is that if you use the connection matrix provided by the data, you explain a substantial proportion of the variance, and remember, this is noisy aggregated data from multiple sources, so this may be something close to the percent of the data you might hope to explain for those genes. And somewhat more for the YPD genes than for the Young genes. And I should add, actually, that what I'm calling here Young is not the Young data, but it's the union of these two. So actually, if I'd used the Young data alone, which I didn't do, this number probably would have been even smaller, since it's mixed with these YPD genes that are relatively well explained. Now, what I did then was I randomized the connections. So I basically took the connection, the factors that were connected to a particular gene, and assigned it to another gene, and then ran the program again. What you see is that a substantial proportion of the variance is still explained by what appear to be spurious relationships. Now, and that illustrates, I think, a couple of things. One is that the percent of variance explained is not a good measure. Let's say there's a gene that's connected to, let's say it's one of the GAL genes connected to GAL4 and two other genes. Okay, well, I randomly assigned that to a ribosomal gene. Okay, and then I took the ribosomal, the factors controlling its synthesis, and assigned that to some enzyme for glycolysis, and so on. Right. It presumably, one thing we do see is that if you randomize again, okay, you just choose a different random connection, this number doesn't change. Okay, so this difference between 50 and 43 is real, but it represents sort of the explanation, essentially, that you get by using the correct connection matrix. I think part of the reason this column is so high is that there are some global trends in the data that weren't completely removed by the normalization, and those can be sort of explained by the fitting. This number should decrease. This test will get more stringent, basically as I get more experimental data, and as I get a richer set of connections. Since I don't expect the number of factors to increase, but I'd like the ratio, as I said, of genes to factors, which is kind of the basic thing in this problem, to increase. Yeah. Yes. The ratio of measurements to parameters is only about 5 to 1 for the smaller data set, and it's about 10 to 1 for the larger data set. Yeah.
When you randomize, do you reserve the statistics of the connection?
Yeah, because I randomized the connection sets for each gene rather than the individual.
So what did you do with the noise?
The noise term in this particular case, I just it was assumed to be the same for all the data, and you'll see that may not be the case. So this was just 1,000 randomly selected measurements. This is on the log scale. This is the fitted model to the experimental data. Sort of demonstrates kind of the expected deviation at low expression values. There's some suggestion that the fitted data may be slightly underpredicting the experimental data at higher ratios, but this is not considering the heterogeneity of the data. This is not bad. This is just, as I said, 1,000 randomly selected measurements.
In the trends that you saw with your variance data, could you assume that in each experiment, whatever, 5% of the genes were active and the other ones were really active? So assuming you have a synthetic model where 5% of the genes were active and completely followed your model, and the other 95% were just noise, and then you do these...
I'm assuming phenomena like that underlie the fact that the randomly connected model still fits the data. Yeah, that's exactly.
You could potentially clean that up by just choosing not to fit anything that was near
zero. Right. Zero, yeah. That was something I've thought about doing. Anyway, so here is a somewhat more convincing thing that I think better shows the difference between the randomly, suggests that the correctly connected data is actually picking out real information. So basically what I did was, we have an estimate for the level of each factor in each experiment, okay? But of course, that particular factor is also a gene that's in the 6,316. And therefore, but of course, in the fitting process, we don't use that information. So what we can do is we can go back and we can try to look at the relationship between the estimated level of each factor across multiple experiments and the transcript for that gene across multiple experiments. Now, obviously, there are a lot of problems with this particular approach to validation. Transcription factors are expressed at low levels, so that they're apt to be noisy estimates, even of the abundance of the transcript. We know that transcript abundance doesn't necessarily correlate with protein abundance, so there are a variety of reasons this is an imperfect match. But here, what you can see is that actually the results are not that bad. Now this was one of the better, but certainly not the best gene. Okay, of the 120 factors, this is from the YPD data set. Of the 120 factors, Around 50 or 60 look pretty much like this. And what you can see here is this is the estimated factor level as derived from the fitting, and this is the level of the transcript corresponding to SIP4. And as you can see, there's a good relationship. This spike at zero is an artifact of the way the missing data is treated. Excuse me? I couldn't say. Yes, it would be. It's hard to say what the error bars in this direction are, because these are, but I would expect them to be somewhat smaller than the observations for individual experiments. Now, here what you can see, and I think this shows better the issue about this particular way of validation clearly ought to depend on the correctness of the connection matrix, because we shouldn't be able to get this kind of a relationship if I've randomly reassigned all the genes that are regulated by this transcription factor to other genes. And here what you can see, what I've done is I've taken all the transcription factors, and I've plotted on the x-axis the correlation, basically what you saw for SIP4, where I think the correlation was around 0.5, the correlation for the correct assignment, and versus the correlation that I get when I randomize the connections. And what you can see is that with the young data, I'm hard put to see a difference, which suggests to me again that in conjunction with the comments that people made yesterday and the observation that I'd made that I described, I wouldn't say that the young data is near random, because clearly that's not the case. But by the same token, there clearly is a substantial. This method does not work terribly well with the connection data from the Young website, which is unfortunate, as I said, because it's certainly the largest systematic data set on connections between factors and genes that could be found. And this is what I get if I just use the YPD data. Here are the correlations for the using the correct connection set. Here are the correlations using the random connection set. And what you can see is that basically the red spots that were present about equally on both sides of the line here have migrated primarily to the right side of the line when we use the correct connection matrix, which is about what we would expect. And this is looks at the average error fitted versus experiment. And what you can see is that, first of all, this is a rather noisy possibly predicting an earthquake right here next Tuesday. But what you can see is that there's a clear break between the first 300 experiments, which represent the Rosetta data, and the other experiments, which appear to be of roughly uniform quality. These particular spikes generally represent just single experiments, and each of the data sets, the public data sets that I had, was probably represents somewhere around 10 consecutive lines on this chart. So it's not that there's a public, there is no one of the other data sets that's consistently worse than the rest, and obviously even Rosetta is not perfect. Okay, so conclusions. We have a flexible but simple model of transcription that can be solved rapidly and reproducibly. It will, the quality of the connection matrix is clearly critical to the final result. I'm anxious to get more sources of high quality connection information. So one of the possibilities is going back and seeing if the Young data set can be better extracted. And with this system, as you see, I can accommodate diverse expression data. So I'm certainly looking for additional data. As I said, the time to solve these models actually depends only linearly on the amount of expression. So if I got another 1,000 experiments, it'd go up to about 4 minutes. And one of the questions then is studying the relationship between the connection strength, which is the magnitude of this coefficient, and other factors such as position, orientation, and multiplicity of the binding sites. And again, another plea for people who have additional data of either expression or connection type. And that's it. Thank you. Question? Yeah. I could let's see now. You mean to compare? That would be an interesting question. Right. Okay. I will do that.
Have you thought about using some sort of validation set to prove to clean up your connections?
For the YPD data set, it wasn't an issue because these were all experimentally verified. So I was willing to accept those. For the young data set, that's one of the things that I thought about. For example, was I could look at try to estimate sort of what the predictive value of some of the connections was, and maybe perhaps use that as a way of pruning. I'm sure there's something in the Young data. I don't have any question about that. But there does seem to be, if we just take their sort of default p-value, there does seem to be some additional filtering that's going to be necessary before it's useful for this kind of modeling. Yeah.
Well, when you have a in the Young data set, they only provide connectivity, but you need to have a direction whether this factor serves as activator or repressor. How do you get that information?
Oh, that just comes out of the sign of alpha. It'll be positive for the activators and negative for the repressors.
Although you have to be a bit careful with the interpretation because a decrease in activation shows up as a negative
right.
X.
That's
and
true.
Also, a de-repression right. can show up as a positive one. So you only know whether the set of targets goes up in expression, but it can be
right.
two mechanisms in the
right.
case.
Right.
You can take that Young data, put robustness in your title, and find a positive result. the question is, we had some people, we talked last week for a couple of weeks, claiming that you could use almost many, many values of parameters and get the same output results. And the question is how. So then, out of your set, some parameters must be very shallow directions, and others must be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Can you distinguish?
No. I haven't looked at that. I think the it is clearly, as I said, I'm quite convinced by looking at the correlation with the transcript levels that the YPD data is useful and that the Young data, at least without some further editing, is contaminated, at least to some extent. Yeah?
Do simple classification type things check whether the parameters are
stable? Yeah, that's planned, but I haven't done that yet.
So one problem is that you have so many sensitive factors and you have a few hundred experiments, but
not all 700 experiments independent. Some many experiments look very similar to each other.
Absolutely.
For the possible overfitting, is there any way you actually can estimate the information content of the data as well as the parameters to see really how many parameters you need?
How many truly independent experiments I have?
Yeah,
that's a good question. Many of these it's hard to say. Many of these data sets if you look at many of the data sets involve a lot of different perturbations of the system. The Rosetta thing does. The cost and stress data set, which is 172 experiments, involves multiple ways of insulting, depriving, and otherwise harming yeast, changing a pH, temperature, alkalinity, acidity. So, and then there are time courses. So I think in terms of the, a related question is, how many independent modes are there for yeast transcription as a whole? And how many of the, clearly, there are some rarer systems that haven't been activated, like the copper response, for example, I don't think is represented in this data, and that corresponds to, three or four or five genes. So there are certainly some small ones, but I think many of the major systems have been activated and in some sort of independent ways, but I don't have a concrete number. Yeah? Yes. For the Young data set, I had 108,973 parameters and about 1.7 million observations.
It's 1 to 10 basically.
What's that?
It's ratio of 1 to 10.
Oh, it's more like 1 to 15. And for the smaller data set, the ratio was about 1 to 5, which is, as I said, not as many as I would like, which is why I'd like.
So maybe 1 to 5 is, maybe getting close to or getting problems.
Oh, I'm well aware of it. And I think the best solution is to get more connection data. Yes?
I've been looking at the same configuration between these fits with a postdoc in my lab, but we only used the Spellman data. We started from MDP1, one of the vectors. And in fact, when we did this alternative iteration, mm-hmm. exactly the same way, we found that we went to a fixed point that corresponded to the connection matrix that only has a single one for one gene,
uh-huh.
and otherwise has zeros. Somehow, and then of course you have this expression of that module, which
right.
would also be the same. So
yes.
Somewhere between 81, which is the number of experiments in there, and your set of 700,
right.
There's a phase transition, if you
yes.
like,
right.
between where you have a non-trivial fixed point where you seem to go to others.
Right.
But we did observe that it took dozens of iterations where there was a slow drift, and suddenly you would go to the basin of attraction of this.
Yeah.
Fixed point. So, how many iterations did you do in practice?
Small numbers.
Okay.
Like less than 10.
Ah, so
we're generally
the same effect?
Sufficient. No, because I've carried out for many more iterations, and I get the same. That doesn't happen. In the simulation experiments, I observe some similar sorts of things. Increasing the number of experiments definitely helps in reducing the number of false. False positives. Yeah?
If you reduce it to just transcription factors?
Excuse me?
If you reduce it to just the transcription factors, connection and expression?
Uh-huh. You'd have a very small number of... Yeah. You would have overfitting in spades. Right.
One more remark. The paper by Namar Barkai's group in Nature Genetics, it's very similar in spirit to this also. If you think, they phrase it in a very different language. Essentially, what they do is they start with some set of features, like a motif. They get the average expression of those genes. It's very similar to this
mm-hmm.
this inferred transcription
right.
activity. And they also correlate that then with the expression profile of individual genes, which essentially is the Pearson correlation.
Right.
They use a different type
right.
of correlation.
Yeah.
Measure.
So actually, I
but it's in spirit.
Right.
It's a very
right.
similar.
I should add that I use that essentially to initialize the process. So my initial estimation of the factors is actually just sort of the average level of all the genes that are activated by that factor uniquely. Okay.
Thank you very much.